Hi, this is Tony Robbins again. Listen, I am thrilled to offer you this special tape on Personal Power 2, The Driving Force, which is really just a conversation with some remarkable people. This whole tape, by the way, is really taken from conversations I've had with people I consider to be my best friends, my teachers, my coaches, on subjects that I think are most important. And they all come from Power Talk, which is my monthly audio magazine. So if you don't want this 30 days to be the end, which I hope you don't, I hope you aren't sick of me, you see some value, then let me be your friend once a month where I can come in and give you the very best topics I know of in the areas that shape your life. And also let me introduce you to some extraordinary human beings, some of whom are friends of mine, some of who are people I've pursued because I know they're geniuses in their category and I want to know what they have to share. So I go out and instead of just having that conversation personally with them, I have it personally and I bring you the best of it to your living room, to your home, to your car. So I've decided that there are three areas that I wanted you to have some additional information on values and really affecting your business, your career, and your life with Stephen Covey. Because Stephen is a man who absolutely lives his message. He walks his talk. He's a man of total integrity and one of the people I respect most in the world. So you'll be learning some of his tools, and it's a sample of a conversation we had in Power Talk, which, by the way, he said was his best interview to date. And we don't end there. I then bring in a second conversation in the area of health, because if we don't master that, especially the mental side of it, because very often we eat well, do well, but then we pollute our brains, and we don't really understand the power of thought and how it shifts, how the power of emotion shifts our physical bodies. So we did a tape on this with you here at Personal Power 2, but I wanted to introduce you to one of the people that I respect most in this area, and that is Dr. Deepak Chopra. He is an absolute genius when it comes to understanding the physiology of human thought and emotion and understanding how it shifts us. So I wanted to at least introduce you to that. And then thirdly, I thought, well, we want to enhance what you know about your relationships. And also, to make sure that we have a balanced view and got a woman's point of view, I've also brought you Dr. Barbara DeAngelis. And I have a power talk I did with her that you'll love. And there's a guy right now that's hot as a pistol. I'm sure you've heard of him. If you're involved in relationships or making it better, I'm sure you've heard of Dr. John Gray. He wrote that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and all the sequels that have come out of that. The conversation we had lasted about 3.5 hours, and it was constant laughter. So I think you'll not only learn from this, but really enjoy it. Again, you're just going to get a sneak peek into a little bit of our conversation, but hopefully enough here that it'll really trigger you, give you a couple of ideas, a couple little tools to give you an idea of what's possible, to expand what you think about relationships, about your career, about your values, and about your body, your mind-body effect. So I hope you enjoy this tape. And I hope at the end of it, you'll write down some notes about what you think you can use from the principles you've learned from these great teachers. Hi, this is Tony Robbins. Welcome to the Power Talk interview portion. And today, I'm fortunate enough to be home, which I never get to do these interviews in. And I have the privilege of being with a man that I'm sure you heard of. His name is Dr. Stephen Covey. And I've been an admirer of Stephen's for many years. I feel like he is a force for good in the business community and I think in our culture as a whole. He's one of those unique individuals that talks about honor and human dignity and character and who really lives it. And I have tremendous respect for you, Stephen, and I couldn't be more thrilled to have you be here.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's good to be in your humble abode.
Well, thank you.
We just call it home.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. I want to make sure people know a little bit more about you, those maybe who haven't heard of you. You're the head of the Covey Leadership Center, which is a nonprofit organization based in Provo, and it's all based on principle-centered leadership. You're also the author of the national best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And what I love about you personally is that you're about one of the most congruent human beings that I know, and that's one of the things I value most. Your caring and your compassion and your desire to help people to remember that they're not a stimulus response being, but that they can choose the way to live, and that their need for contribution and interdependence, those themes I think are so important in our society today, and that honor is more important than things like moods or temporary desires. I've really tried to base my work on principles, values. You do the same. So I'd like to get into those, but I think before we do anything else, what I'd love to do, if you'd be willing to allow us, is find out more about your background. You know, in your books and in your tapes, we get to hear some of the stories about your family and some of the people you've interacted with, but Maybe we could start out by having you tell us what shaped you, what's made you the man of the character that you are. What are some of the events or experiences that have given you these values and made you want to study this whole idea of effectiveness within human relationship and human behavior?
Well, I think the primary influence source would be my own family, my parents. My mother, for instance, was a person who had no respect. She was not a respecter of persons. In other words, there was no sense inside of her of preferring one person over another. And then my father, he never was a person who would talk about himself and about his things. He says, because if you do, you might make other people who don't have those things or those opportunities feel lessened to some degree. And he was modest, and he wanted to make a difference. And so he spent 15 years of his life producing a book to be read by 16 people, people of influence, and it did impact them. It was a powerful book.
And what was it called?
It's called The Revelation Monument Building. It was a recommendation for a special building to be built in a certain location to show how God deals with his children through art and architecture. In fact, it was all done anonymously. Anonymous service was a very key element of his life. And so these kinds of influences, I think, gave to me a desire that I want to make a difference, and also to make that difference in a principled way. And then I got into my graduate work. I really did a lot of kind of cramming in my undergraduate work. I find a lot of people did, you know, where you kind of read the tea leaves as to how do you get good grades with the least possible effort. And then I paid a terrific price when I got into my graduate work, and I was in a hospital in about 3 months with ulcerated colitis.
I was about 21,
I guess.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
I was trying to kind of make up for, oh, perhaps years of cramming, and I was trying to do it in a cramming way. And I started to get involved in the whole idea there isn't a quick fix in life. And not to look for it, and to emotionally free yourself from it so that you can focus on something that really has permanency and that does contribute. I had a friend there who was a teacher in the university. He was a speech professor, and he was a very popular speaker and was used all around the country on the different circuits and so forth. And I said to him near his retirement, if you were to do it differently, what would you do? He said, I would build an organization. He said, I would empower so that there was something that had lasting value, that there was had carry-on and carry-through value. I also went on a mission for the Mormon Church over in Great Britain. And when I was there, my mission president called me and asked me to train leaders for small branches, we called them, that were the spiritual leaders of small groups of people. And I was just a young man at the time, and I had no idea of that potential in me, and he apparently saw that I could train leaders, so that became a very formative influence as well, his influence on me.
So his belief in you. You talked a little bit about some of the discoveries that you made with your own children. You're the father of 9 children. I should mention that as well. I thought I had my hands full with 4, and I was really accomplishing something, having an impact.
It's kind of like a daily laboratory, isn't it?
It sure
to
is.
To test your ideas.
every day, every moment. But tell me a little bit about your own children. But before I skip on to that, I guess I have so many things I want to ask you. Maybe I should keep chronological here. You went to work as a professor at BYU.
Right.
At the Marriott School of Management.
Right.
What made you decide to become a professor, and then how did that evolve into the 7 habits?
Well, when I did my undergraduate and then I did my mission work, I became very interested in training, developing leaders. So when I went to the Harvard Business School, I focused on the human side in the second year, where you were given a lot of electives. And then I decided, we had a good family business going. It was a 3-generation business, but I think that my father really found most of his satisfactions working on that project I mentioned, rather than from business. And it caused me to ask the question, now really, what do I want to give my life to? And I decided not to go into the family business, but rather to go into teaching people. I thought that teaching had high leverage opportunities, so I started to teach at the Brigham Young University, and I taught there for about five years. And then I went on another mission to Ireland for 3 years, and then I came back, went into the administration of Brigham University, then back into teaching after a period of time. And then I decided I would really like to make an impact on the world. So I kind of distilled the essence of what I'd been learning working with organizations and people over a period of, I guess, about 20 years into the concept that private victories always precede public victories.
Yes.
And that out of true, deep character strength lies the power of both courage and compassion. And to me, the unique juxtaposition of courage and compassion is the essence of the foundation of an interdependency in the world. And so I became enamored by that idea, and I got into it, and I began to think, now, what would help produce, see, this private victory? Well, to take responsibility for your own life. So that's habit one, see.
Right.
And then, well, what is your life about? That's habit two. Right. And then to live by it, that's habit three. So in a sense, those three kind of fundamental ideas comprise the foundation for the private victory. Now, what's the public victory? Well, it's that you essentially regard other people with great respect and dignity and treat them accordingly. And how do you solve problems then? You have to listen to them first before you seek to be listened to. And then you try to go into synergy, which means you create something that is better than what either proposed initially. And out of those three represent the essence of the public victory, or the essence of interdependency, which is what life is. See, so then I started working with that material. You know how it goes as you go out in training, you get a lot of feedback and you hone the material.
And then you figure out how to keep that by reinforcing it through the,
right,
the whole idea of sharpening the saw.
Right, and sharpening the saw, that's habit seven. So then I decided, but I don't want to just be a speaker. I really want to get this thing institutionalized, and I want to see it has carry-on value, see,
right,
to really impact lives. So that's why I left BYU and went into setting up a business, and takes us where we are today, I guess.
Well, we have very similar goals. I had the same things that shaped me. I looked at people doing speeches, and I thought, you know, how long will the impact last? And as you know, building an organization requires a little bit more energy and impact and focus than just going out and doing the speeches, but it gives you the opportunity to continue to touch people. And one of the things I think you do uniquely as a communicator and a speaker is that most of the companies you work with, if I understand correctly, you come back and work with them over a period of a year. Is that correct?
That's one of the programs, yes, where we meet with them once a month for about 3 to 4 hours over a year's period of time.
Yes.
But the real key I have found is to train people inside their own organizations.
Yeah. Their own champions, if you would.
Yes, so that they then start teaching others, who in turn teach others, practice it, report back on their experiences in both teaching and applying, so that they start to get a sense of responsibility toward the material and accountability.
And momentum.
It does. It does create a momentum. There's a natural momentum of enthusiasm because it actually impacts lives. So when people come back, they say, what did you do? Well, I tried this circle of influence idea, and I just focused only on the things that I could work on. I can't tell you what that did to my marriage, or what it did with this teenage son that I've had nothing but headaches with.
Yes.
Or what it did in my executive team. Then they report, really? Well, it didn't work with me. Why did you do it? And they learn from each other. It becomes a kind of synergistic learning environment. So that, in a sense, my speech maybe was a catalyst to start it off. But in all sincerity, the power is when they do it with themselves.
Yes, I agree.
One of the little things I use in my presentations is a compass. And I ask people at the beginning of the speech to point north, to close their eyes and point north. And usually about, 30-40% actually have it correct. But that's the way it is with most people in most organizations. They really don't know where true north is.
Yeah.
Then I say, well, true north, you notice, is an external reality. That's what principles are. See, values are internal. Principles are external. And the key is to get our value system, which is the arrow of the compass. I gradually show that the compass never changes. True north never changes. But our value system is manifested in our habit patterns, and in an organization they're called our practices, is to get into alignment with true north or with principles. Then you get in harmony with the laws of nature.
Yes.
You get in harmony with what Carl Jung called the unconscious. the collective unconscious that pervades all humanity, regardless of their upbringing, their religion, their cultural heritage, their scripting, whatever it is, there is something far more basic and generic at that level than most people know about. And I find that no matter where we go in developing mission statements, if you get enough people interacting freely, feeling safe in the interaction, and where they're really synergistic, you know, where they're learning from each other, and also when they're very informed on the full nature of the problems in their situation, all the mission statements become the same. They all know where True North is.
So in what way?
They all basically describe not the vision part of the mission statement, what the, you know, what their enterprise is about, but the principles part of the mission statement always basically deals with four things: our physical being and our economic well-being. See, so the principle there is fundamentally to be fair toward people. And then the social part, that is having to do with relationships and the creation of a culture that has what I call an immune system in it, so we can handle any problems that come down the pike, and has this great ability to solve problems regardless. The principle there has to do with how you treat people. Kindness and dignity and so forth, and respect. You see people as a separate individual of equal worth to yourself. Then the third area they always deal with, inevitably, is how do you develop people? That's the psychological nature. How do you identify their talents? Then how do you develop them? Then how do you use them? That's the missing area in this country in most organizations, is how to use people's talents.
Yes.
The top people are being used, but the many other levels are not empowered at all. And that's why we have such a hard time competing in a global marketplace against major organizations from the Far East and from Europe that are more fully using people's capacities and talents. Then the fourth area has to do with, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? It's the spiritual nature. Yes. That is, are you making a difference? Do you really make a contribution? Do you add value? Does your life matter? In my next project I'm working on, I'm essentially bringing this together, and I'm calling it The Fire Within. You'd like that.
Yeah.
The Fire Within, to live, see, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Wow. Trying to show how the four basic needs. And then I'm going to try to show how that pertains to every individual, every organization, and every society.
Fantastic. Tell me, you know, one of the major frames of reference that have shaped you is the whole concept of paradigms. Understanding that rather than just trying to change a behavior or a strategy or a single value, to really change the entire system, the entire way of looking at life, the entire belief systems. It's one of the things that we share in common. It's one of the things a lot of our graduates who are listening have experienced through Date with Destiny, a program that we do to make that kind of change happen. What I'm really getting towards is the 7 habits of success. Actually, we're talking about highly effective people. And I love your definition of effectiveness. Can we touch on that?
I like it because everyone resonates with it. Yeah. Just yesterday I was with a group and I said to a woman there, I said, you're a career woman and you also have a family. She said, yes. I said, how do you like to have a clean home? She says, well, I just don't, but I like it. I said, well, what would a success be to you? Wouldn't that be to have a clean home plus that your children do their jobs cheerfully without being reminded? And she thought, she said, oh, yeah, that would be it. I said, that's the definition of success. I use the word effectiveness to get away from the word of success because it tends to connote only getting desired results.
Right.
But you have to constantly nurture the assets that produce those desired results. So if your emotional bank account with your kids are high and you have win-win performance agreements and high trust, then you could have a box where you put money in and say, take your allowance out. And you judge your own performance. I always ask audiences, if trust is high, if the emotional bank account is high, are people easier or harder on themselves? Yeah. Always harder. Well, then where do we get the concept of external performance appraisal? You know, the old sandwich technique, say a few nice words, slip in the knife, areas for improvement, twist it a few times, the sandwich technique at the end. See, it's turning people again into things that you're manipulating. Why not become their servant, their helper, their facilitator, their coach, and instead of the sandwich technique, say to them, how's it going? Let them evaluate themselves. Now, make sure they have stakeholder information system data that comes to them so they're not just going on their own
self. So that people know what you mean by that. Can you clarify?
Stakeholder information system basically means that you you gather data from the perceptions and feelings of the people that they interact with in a very systematic and scientific way. For instance, you wouldn't want to promote someone that didn't have high marks from their own direct reports.
Right.
That's a revolutionary idea. And from their bosses and from the other departments they interface with, see? That tells you they're a team person. Now, if you're only going to look at independent qualities, go ahead and promote them if they're an independent contributor. But if you're expecting someone to be a manager or a leader to have interdependency qualities, then you better gather information from all the stakeholders. I predict in the matter of a few years, the organizations that are not deep into stakeholder information systems with all stakeholders, including the community and suppliers, obviously employees and customers,
right,
will not be around.
Wow. I am extremely excited to be sitting across the desk here from a gentleman who I've respected for many years. His name is Dr. Deepak Chopra. Dr. Chopra has a pretty phenomenal history, and many of you who have been with me throughout the years know how strongly I feel about the power of physiology to shape human emotion, human behavior, and ultimately our destiny. And the choices that we have to make along the way rather than giving the responsibility to somebody else. And I've exposed you to many different people, from Bernie Siegel to Norman Cousins just before he died. So to be with Deepak Chopra, I just want you to know this man, I believe, is one of the living masters in being able to teach people the fundamentals of what reality really is beyond the physical body, what really shapes our lives. So it's really a privilege to be with you, Deepak.
It's a privilege to meet you, Tony. I've admired you for a long time.
Well, thank you. We're here in Lancaster, Massachusetts, and we're at the Ayurvedic Center, Health Center here. And I think maybe what we could do is start out by just giving people a little bit of your background. You have a very traditional medical background, and yet now you're considered by most to be, I think, the foremost expert in the area of understanding mind-body medicine or psychoneuroimmunology. Why don't you give us a little background? Where did the shift happen for you?
The shift happened a while after I had been in practice. I was an academic to start with. I was teaching at Boston University School of Medicine and at Tufts and for a while at Harvard. And that part was so exciting from an intellectual point of view and so challenging that I was very happy doing that. But when I really started going into practice and seeing patients, I found that the academic intellectual challenges, exciting as they were, really had very little to do with how people got well.
Yes.
I was sitting there spending all my day writing prescriptions, and at the end of the day I would feel that I had been a legal drug pusher, because what was I doing? I was writing prescriptions for tranquilizers, sleeping pills, and antibiotics. If I ever told my patients, listen, maybe if you stop smoking or cut down on your alcohol or changed your weight, perhaps we could wean you off some of these drugs. And they'd say, well, you know, doc, my mother-in-law says the same thing. She doesn't charge me $50. How do I do it? And if you look back, you realize that medicine perhaps has all the answers, but it doesn't have the technologies to make people want to change.
Yes.
Or even if they want to change, doesn't have the technologies to show them how to change.
Yes.
It was very frustrating. So it was my unhappiness that led me out from what I was doing.
Pain drove you to something.
Yes, pain.
So what was the evolution of it then for you? Where did you begin to look? You were born in India, correct?
Right.
And so was your experience, your exposure to Ayurvedic medicine back then, was that, were you going back to your roots? What triggered you to go there for the answers? Or did you start out there?
No, but actually I had a background in India, and some of it was a distorted perception of what Ayurveda was. I used to think of it as some kind of folklore or folk medicine.
Yes.
With a lot of herbology, but nothing more to it. In 1980, I started practicing transcendental meditation. In 1985, I was at a medical conference, and Maharishi was there in Washington. And after the conference, he sort of asked me to come to his room, which I did out of politeness more than anything else, because I wasn't interested in anything that had to do with quote-unquote mysticism.
Yes.
And I found him to be a very practical man. We talked for a while, and he said to me that I should look, with my background in medicine, I should look into Ayurveda. I was polite enough to say that I would, but I didn't mean to. I left the meeting, and I went to the airport to go home. And at the airport, I met an old friend of mine from medical school, and he handed me a book. He said, "This is about Ayurveda. Maybe you find it interesting." So I said, "There's some message here."
Yes.
I read the book. It was fascinating. I went back to Maharishi. I said, "Send me to India. Let me meet all the people who are experts in it. I really want to get into this." And I did.
Wow. Now, at that time, were you the chief of staff at New England?
Yes,
Memorial?
I was.
They must have thought you were crazy.
Yes, I was. And initially, the response was, yes, that I was off the wall. My partners didn't know what I was up to. Some of them were even embarrassed about all the things I was engaged in. But I didn't care anymore.
I
was on the mission, yeah.
Now, what began to make you believe that you really have found some answers here beyond your traditional medical training?
For one thing, I was able to influence people in a way I had never been able to do it. I was able to make them lose weight or stop smoking or give up alcohol, to make them want to be healthy. And then I started seeing some dramatic remissions in illness, in chronic illness. I'd have patients come here, for example, and they'd be taking 15 medicines, about 10 for their problem and 5 for the side effects from the medicines that they were taking.
Yeah.
And within a week or two, we'd have them off everything, and they didn't have this problem anymore. They'd have bronchial asthma for 15 years, and now they don't have it anymore.
Yeah.
Or they've been taking drugs for arthritis for 10, 15 years, and it's not there anymore. And then when we started seeing occasionally a dramatic remission and somebody would say cancer, you start thinking, what's really happening here? Are we really, we've missed out on perhaps a few billion years of learning experience, because the human body, as it turns out, is an exquisite pharmacy. It makes every drug that Hoffman LaRoche makes and more.
Better quality.
Better quality, the right dose, the
right
target organ. No side effects.
Cheaper.
Cheaper. You have access to it, and all the instructions are there in the packaging.
Yes.
So I said, and it's evolved over billions of years of evolutionary time. All the mistakes, you know, you can make the precise antibody for pneumococcus because some ancestor a few hundred thousand years ago perfected that technique, and you have it inside your body.
In your DNA.
In your DNA. So why not use this huge library of information?
So what prevents us from doing that?
Interference.
Social hypnosis?
Yeah, it's the hypnosis of social conditioning. It's violation of basic, simple laws of nature that make our body function. There are simple processes going on in our body all the time. The simple processes are eating, breathing, digestion, metabolism, elimination, and something that controls all of these, and that's consciousness. Thought, at a very fundamental level, non-verbal, not linguistically structured and verbally elite and speaking in the English language with an Indian accent,
but communication.
But communication,
a
network of communication, a network of intelligence, communication and information, which is controlling all these processes. You get in touch with these processes, and you eliminate 95% of all disease. You can even reverse most of disease if you get in touch with these basic life processes. That leaves about 5-6% of disease, which is genetic. But even genetic disease is the stress of our ancestors. If we pay attention to what we're doing in our generation, we'll be doing the next generation a lot of good.
Makes sense. You and I both know from our mutual studies and individual studies that the power of belief to change biochemistry, to change instantaneously the way the body responds to anything, it's that sense of certainty. And some people are trying to pursue it through affirmations and pumping themselves up, but rarely does that really give you the sense of certainty. Whatever we're certain about really in our heart of hearts seems to show up in our body. And I think I read once you said that the body is a printout of our consistent thoughts or our consciousness. Tell me, what is the biggest misconception that we have about the human body? What is the metaphor that we're using that's keeping us locked in where we're always at the effect of rather than understanding we're truly the cause of our experience?
The biggest mistake is that we are steeped in the superstition of materialism. The superstition of materialism says that this world is made up of physical objects in space and time, and if there is such a thing as thought or consciousness, then it's the epiphenomenon of matter. In other words, if I have thoughts and feelings and emotions and desires and instincts and drives and likes and dislikes and passions and hatred, if I believe in God or heaven or hell or salvation or damnation or communism or feminism, all these things occur because there's the dance of molecules in my body. That biochemical reactions somehow produce the epiphenomenon that we call thought. That we are physical machines that have learned how to think. Well, in fact, it's probably reverse, the other way around. Yeah. Not probably, surely the other way around. We are thoughts that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are impulses of intelligence in a larger universe of intelligence. This is a thinking universe. We are impulses of intelligence in a larger void of intelligence that have learned how to create physical matter. We create the mind. We are not the mind. We create the mind. We create the body. And through our body and our mind, we ultimately create the experience of the world. By itself, the world is just quantum soup. It's a radically ambiguous, ceaselessly flowing field of all possibilities. And out of that field of all possibilities, we can create anything we want. We're like King Midas. Only he knew only how to create gold. Everything he touched turned into gold. We can create anything we want.
Greater level of choice.
Much, infinite choice.
Yes. Tell me, what is the body?
If you went to a physicist, a really first-class physicist, and asked her, what's the real...
Asked her, I like that, very good.
Asked her, what's the real nature of the physical body? She might say, if you could look at it, not through the artifact of sensory experience, then you'd see, which is, you know, the superstition that what I can see and touch and taste and smell is the way things only are. That's wrong. After all, my senses tell me that the earth is flat and nobody believes that anymore. The senses tell us that the ground we're standing on is stationary and we know it's spinning at dizzying speeds.
Or the light we see in the sky at night is still there when it may be gone millions of years ago.
Exactly. Yes. So forget the superstition of materialism and begin to see things as they really are. Well, the physicist would tell you that the body is a dynamic field of energy, information, and intelligence that's constantly renewing itself in every second of its existence. That you, in fact, make a new body once a year. That even this moment, you have a million atoms in your body that were once in the body of Christ, or Buddha, or Genghis Khan, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Saddam Hussein, for that matter. That your physical body is a river of intelligence and information. 98% of all the atoms come and go in less than 1 year. You make a new skin once a month, a new skeleton every 3 months, a new stomach lining every 5 days. Even the brain cells that you think with as carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen, they weren't there 1 year ago. And the DNA, the genetic material, which holds millions of years of information, the actual raw material, the carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, comes and goes like migratory birds every 6 weeks.
So let me ask you a question. Somebody has cancer, and the first thing that the average person does, obviously, is immediately respond with horror, with fear. They immediately are told by their doctor they have so much time to live, or they have so much percentage of chance of living. They now think to themselves, I have this thing in my body I've got to get rid of. What you're saying is that thing in their body they call tumor is not going to be the same tumor a year from now. Is that true?
It's true. If I look at an x-ray and see a tumor and I compare it with the tumor from 6 months ago, am I really looking at the same tumor? The answer is, on the material level, no. Every single atom of carbon, of hydrogen, of oxygen, of nitrogen that makes up this tumor is not the same, is different from the tumor 6 months ago because of the rapid changeover.
Right.
However, because the underlying quantum mechanical framework is the same, in other words, the cellular memory is the same, or the underlying physiological processes at a non-material level are the same, it keeps coming back the same way. It's like if I had the ability to change every brick in this building once a year, but I'm stuck with the notion this is the only way to do it, I'd get the same looking building every time. If I want to get rid of this tumor, I have to exorcise the ghost of this tumor. And by the ghost of this tumor, I mean the impulses of information, energy, transformation, memory, conditioned response, all the things that structure the non-physical aspects of the tumor that result in this physical expression. It's estimated, for example, that we have 60,000 thoughts a day. That's not surprising. The disconcerting thing is that most people, 95% of the thoughts they have today are the ones they had yesterday. So we become bundles of conditioned reflexes and responses constantly being triggered by people and circumstance into very predictable biochemical outcomes, behavioral outcomes, and ultimately physical outcomes. So the body turns over 6 billion cells a day. 1% of these are mutations. So everybody's body has cancer cells all the time.
That's right.
But we get rid of them every day.
The problem is, though, if we keep putting the same cause in motion, the same thought cause, the same belief cause, the same expectation cause, then we're going to keep getting the same result because we're going to take the material and we're going to translate it accordingly. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, exactly. The recipe remains the same. You can take the same ingredients, have another recipe, and you'll have something else.
Because we're funneling it in identical ways.
Exactly.
So until we change, it sounds complex, but what we're really saying is until we change our basic core fundamental beliefs, our sense of certainty about what is and what will be, then whatever we are certain about will be in our lives, as we think so we'll experience.
Exactly. In fact, Tony, what it is it's an interpretation of what's happening to you. If I go out on a joyride on Magic Mountain in Disney World, and my interpretation is at a deep level, somewhere, I believe, as you said, in the deepest part, this is fun. Then my body makes interleukins and interferons. These are powerful anti-cancer drugs.
That's right.
If you had to buy interleukin to treat melanoma or kidney cancer, a full course would cost you something like $40,000 and a lot of side effects. But you could take that joyride and make $1 million worth of interleukin too, if at the core of your being, you were having fun. On the other hand, if your interpretation was this is terror, then you'd make cortisol and adrenaline and all kinds of things which destroy the immune system.
Yes.
The difference between destruction of the immune system and stimulation of the immune system, a difference which could mean the crucial difference between life and death, is an interpretation. I take an experience and I say, this is a very tranquil experience. I'm having the experience of tranquility at a deep level of awareness. My body, my leukocytes, my adrenal cells, my macrophages will start churning out Valium. This Valium, unlike the one that you buy from Hoffman LaRoche, is the real diazepam. It is the molecule of tranquility.
Yes.
And it modifies and modulates the activity of the immune system so that cells can do their job in tranquility. The meaning that you give to an event is the event. Is the event.
What I call it is the label you put upon experience becomes experience.
Exactly, because there is no such thing as actual reality. There is only the perception of reality.
That's correct.
See, and that perception of it is an interpretation that the self makes to the self.
Now, how do we create balance? First of all, what creates imbalances in each three?
Stress. Ultimately, it's all stress.
So what are some of the elements of stress?
The elements of stress are basically how you interact with your environment, with people and situations and circumstances and things.
Emotional stress, physical stress from lack of sleep, stress from eating improperly.
Right. In fact, take two or three things. How you behave, how you think, how and what you eat, period.
Okay, that's good.
How you behave influences your biological rhythms, which means life is a function of cycles of rest and activity.
Yes.
So deep rest is the basis of dynamic activity, and dynamic activity is the basis of deep rest. If you've had a really good dynamic active day, you're going to have a wonderful sleep at night.
Yes.
On the other hand,
as long as you give yourself enough time to do it.
You have to give yourself enough time to do it. It's like children. Look at children. They're totally self-referral. They're totally in the present.
Yes.
And when they fall to sleep, they're gone. That's what blissful sleep is. And just like that, deep rest is the basis of dynamic activity. If you have a hangover, you're not going to be able to do anything effective. So you need both. Yes. And nature functions in these cycles of rest and activity. So watch the signals of comfort and discomfort as they come from your body. These are your inner cues. The universe, in its infinite intelligence, has made it very simple. There are only two signals. One's a signal of comfort, one is the signal of discomfort. The
pain
signal
and pleasure.
Of, yes, exactly. Yes. Or we say joy and suffering.
Yes.
Okay? These are the only two signals. And you tune into these signals that your body is giving out and amplify the signals of comfort and get away from the signals of discomfort. You have what is called spontaneous right action, which means the right action comes to you in every second of your existence. It's the right response to every situation as it occurs. There's a computing system out there which is far more precise, far more accurate, far more reliable than any contained in the realm of rational thought. You just have to tune in. Tune into the signals, and you have the right behavior, the right eating habits. Of course, there are guidelines, and those guidelines are something for you to corroborate your own inner experiences.
Right.
There's no animal in the forest who has the vaguest idea what the U.S. Surgeon General has recommended as the minimal requirement of calcium.
That's probably why he doesn't have loss of bone and he doesn't have cancer in the wild.
Osteoporosis,
anyway.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. Inner cues.
You just notice what works.
Just notice what works. Listen to the inner cues, and the body's inner intelligence is the ultimate and supreme genius. It mirrors the wisdom of the universe. It'll tell you exactly what to do. Most people don't take time to listen.
Get quiet and listen. Huh?
Get quiet and listen.
Meditation. I'm very excited today to have Dr. Barbara DeAngelis with me. She's invited us into her home, and she's actually about to move, so we're getting the last experience here in her home. Barbara, if you're not familiar with her, is the executive director of the Los Angeles Personal Growth Center. She's the creator of the popular relationship seminar, Making Love Work, and what you probably know her for is her best-selling books, How to Make Love All the Time, kind of a fun title, and Secrets About Men Every Woman Should Know. She writes on a regular basis for Cosmopolitan, Ladies Home Journal, McCall's, Reader's Digest, and she's the popular media personality who appears frequently on Oprah Winfrey, Our Magazine, Sally Jesse Raphael, not to mention the fact that she has a variety of cassette tapes that can give you strategies on how to succeed in each area of relationships. So I hope you'll take advantage of those. I want to thank you for letting us in your home and a chance to visit with you.
Thank you. You're the last and best experience here.
Well, thank you. How to Make Love All the Time. What a great title. There are a lot of things in here. Why don't you just clarify, what do you mean by making love all the time?
I really believe that the experience of being in love, in the state of love, is a possibility. In fact, is really the goal for a relationship. And that most of us limit those high moments of connection to sex or to our anniversary, and that you can be in love and feel like you are making love, literally,
right,
with your partner all the time. And that the myth that, well, after 5 years, you lose the magic, and of course you don't feel passionate, and what do you expect? You have three children. That even though it is common that we see that, it is not normal.
Right.
People say to me, but isn't it normal? I mean, doesn't that happen to most marriages? And I say, yes, and that's because it's common. But I don't think it's normal. I think it is normal if you love someone today to love them more in 20 years, not less. But the way we erode relationships by making mistakes, which I mentioned in the book, by the time we get to 5 years, we're lucky if we're even speaking to one another anymore. So I wrote the book, in a sense, like Relationships 101, as a manual for what goes wrong, what can make it work, what to avoid, the basics that I wish was taught in high school, in junior high school.
So
these days, elementary school, probably.
Let's talk about some of the mistakes then. What are some of the biggest mistakes that people make in relationships? I know there's one common theme that struck me really strongly, but what's been the most important distinctions, what have they been, that you've made over the years working with all these people that are the mistakes that we've got to avoid in order to make relationships work at the highest level?
I think two things come to mind. The first, many people are never in the relationship. I don't care if they've been married 40 years, they have
never...
So they've
never committed, in other
words? They have never committed themselves to really being in the relationship. They exist in a relationship coexisting with another person. But if things aren't going their way, they leave. They literally psychically leave or energetically leave that relationship for 10 minutes. They abandon the marriage. And I see couples all the time who have never really committed, no matter what, to working on that relationship. I get calls on the radio every other call. We have a problem. My husband doesn't want to talk about it. Well, what are you doing married if you don't want to talk about it? But this is just rampant. So that's the first thing. Once you're in it, it is absolutely not telling the complete truth to your partner. That includes many things. Asking for what you want, which means you have to know what you want. Letting the resentments and the little problems build up, pushing them down so you don't rock the boat, numbing yourself to them, and that definitely erodes the passion between two people. And not telling the truth about the anger, about the fears, so that your reality remains separate. Intimacy Right. is a shared experience of reality. And if you're not sharing your reality with your partners, even if it's a guy who says, you know what, my inventory's down at work and we're not making enough sales this month and I'm scared to death, that's something your wife needs to know. If she doesn't, you are not sharing a piece of yourself, and you're going to find yourself 3 months down the line not wanting to make love to her, and you won't even think it has to do with what's going at work, but it does.
So it's in other words, it's creating the separation but not sharing fully.
Yes, it's building a wall, an emotional wall that we can feel, but we don't understand where it came from. And some people think a wall is, well, I had an affair and I didn't tell her. But it's the little things that are more insidious. Not asking for what you want. Not letting somebody know that you're not feeling as appreciated as you need to be. It's one brick and another brick and another brick. And then you wake up one day and you look at your partner in the morning and you have that sinking feeling. You know, I love him, but I'm not in love anymore. Where did the magic go? And you really don't know. And it's not that it went. It is buried under right. piles of withheld communications and resentments. The good news is you can create that again. I've seen it happen. I see it happen in my seminars all the time. It's like a miracle. People who were ready to get divorced, who hadn't slept together in 5 years, 2 days, and they are in love again. That's the power of renewal of the human heart.
So from your standpoint, if a couple's gone through threshold, if they're in a position where they really don't feel like they're in love any longer, and there's a desire on either person's part to try and reignite it, put it back together, what are the first steps? What would you tell them to do?
The first thing is for them each to take an accounting of all the things that they are holding inside that are not balanced and not okay. All the things that they've been angry about and hurt about, to use some of the techniques I mentioned, love letters, where they really get to figure out what they're feeling. Once they know not just what they think is bothering them, but what is really bothering them, because I always say people never fight for the reasons they think they're fighting. You know, people come to me and say, we're fighting about the kids and we're fighting about the house. You're fighting because you don't feel loved and you don't feel understood. That is the reason we fight.
Sure.
And if you don't understand that, you could sit there and talk about the kids for the next 5 years and never get anywhere. So first you need to do an exploration so you can get in touch with that little kid inside of you that really needs to say, you know what, honey? You know, I need more attention from you. I'm lonely. I miss you.
So let me tie you down. How do they do that? Do they take out a piece of paper and pencil, do it? They sit down with their partner and just let do a stream of consciousness? What's the best way to go about it?
The best way first is to do it yourself so you're not going to be interrupted by somebody else's reactions, as you said, and interrupt your process. And write what I call a love letter and start out with the anger and go all the way down until you feel the love, until you feel really clear. And you're hopefully your partner can do the same thing. And then you give it to that person and you read it out loud and they read it back. And you start to understand what's going on inside the other person. And you start to understand what's going on inside of you. And that understanding is what begins to recreate the intimacy. I've really found that people can go through just about anything and recover from just about anything in relationship if they can recreate the intimacy. Because the truth is, on one level, we could be intimate and fall in love with anybody. I mean, if someone put...
And most of us have proven it.
Yes, exactly. Well, I certainly have. I mean, you could put, you know, two people on a desert island, and if there were no one else there, they would fall in love. I mean, the human beings have such divinity inside of them that when you transcend all the extraneous stuff, you feel the spirit and you feel yours, and that is the feeling of being in love. You feel love. And I really believe that if couples learn how to get this other stuff out of the way, they can repair. They can repair.
How can they prevent it from ever getting that place in the first place?
Well, number one, if anyone who's listening to this is getting involved in a relationship and has had failed relationships in the past, don't be so innocent to think that just because you're with a new person, you're not going to make the same mistakes again.
Or you moved to Tennessee.
No, exactly. That was my radio show today. That means get some education, read every book you can, take every relationship seminar you can, listen to tapes, you know, sit down together and say, I want to come into this with some different input. You can't just expect that it's going to change by itself. It won't. In fact, it's going to get worse because now you have another set of negative experiences.
More baggage for you.
And your trust level is lower. So unless you've had some extensive relationship education, go out and get it. And don't feel like you're a failure getting it. You're a pioneer. You're somebody who wants excellence. You're not going to settle for a mediocre, boring relationship like most of us are frightened we're going to have.
Right. Well, I think one of the major things, the themes that comes through your books over and over again is that how do you make relationships better is you make them a priority. And I'm a big believer in what I call concentration of power, that whatever you focus on consistently and every day it's got to be better, it will be better, whatever that is.
Absolutely. Human beings, our attention and intelligence is so vast, and our ability to empower things with our attention is so fantastic. And most of us only pay attention to our relationships when they are in crisis. And wait until either, you know, our partner's calling the lawyer or we're having a big fight or it's been a month since we've had sex, and then we start talking about it. And the truth is, if your child had even a sniffle, you'd be running over there. You know, if your business showed a tiny deficit, you'd be taking care of it. You wouldn't wait till the creditors came to the door with the red slips.
Well, I don't know. I think a lot of people do. That's the unfortunate part of a lot of people's businesses. But yes, I hear you.
So it means really understanding that if you want lifelong passion, you're going to have to invest in it, not 24 hours a day, but even 10 quality minutes a day, which most people don't have. I interview women and say, when's the last time your husband gave you a real kiss? Not a peck, but a real kiss. And I see women saying, let's see, Saturday, no, not Saturday, last Monday, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago. I mean, that's tragic. That's tragic. That's why I invented the 20-second kiss, so they could at least get in a few of those a day.
Welcome to another edition of Power Talk. This is Tony Robbins, and I'm very excited today to share with you a person I consider to be a great friend, not only to myself, but all men and women in the world. He's an extraordinary human being. His name is Dr. John Gray, and he's the best-selling author of a book I'm sure you heard of because it's been the number one bestseller forever, called Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. He also wrote a book titled called What Your Mother Couldn't Tell You and Your Father Didn't Know, and then his newest book, which is Mars and Venus in the Bedroom. And he's written several others as well, but he's an amazing genius. And he's allowed us the privilege to come across the Golden Gate Bridge and arrive here in Mill Valley at his offices. It used to be, I guess, your home.
Yes.
And I just want to thank you for having us, John.
It's a real pleasure.
Great. Well, let's start out with this metaphor that is dominating the culture now. People all over the country and around the world are talking about this thing that started out in your book where you said, once upon a time, these two groups of people used to get together and have great relationships, and then something happened. Tell us, what is that metaphor, if you would, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and maybe give us a little idea about how it evolved for you, and what's the promise of it? What does the understanding really give us? I'd really like to know the history of it, though, too, because I read one of your early books that I'd not seen before, and it was back in 1989, and you'd already had the metaphor. And it wasn't as popular then, so give me a sense of that.
Well, to start with, the metaphor itself, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. I remember when I first submitted my book, I was Xeroxing a copy of it. It was right on the counter, and a woman looked at it and went, that's right. I mean, everybody hears this title, they go, that's right, they're from Mars, or yes, they're from Venus. And it's such a, people today are hungry to have a positive way of looking at differences between men and women.
Yes.
Because what's been happening is that when we show up differently in a relationship, we tend to think, what's wrong with my partner?
Right.
What flaw is that? Or they need to go to therapy to fix that. Instead of realizing there's certain differences about men and women which are very healthy, but they're different. One's not better than the other. So I started teaching this about 12 years ago, the gender differences. And then it wasn't such a popular subject. And matter of fact, lots of people get all upset and think it was sexism and whatever. And I kept working at with my groups how to do it in a way where nobody heard it in a negative way, how to create a positive way.
Nobody's offended.
Nobody's offended by it. And there were other people at the time doing this as well. I'm not the first, but what really motivated me to come up with a metaphor of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus is other people were using another metaphor, which was it's like we live in different countries, which is also a good metaphor.
Right.
So I thought, how can I come up with another way? And it was just, we're from different planets. And when I started talking about it, my audiences loved it. And they would come back and say, you got to tell them about the Martian Venusian thing. And then I developed the whole story, which is, you know, it's good to have a story to sort of hold on to. Is the Martians discovered the Venusians. They flew to Venus. They arrived on Venus. They had great relationships, wonderful relationships. And they went on a honeymoon to Earth. And that's kind of what happens. Man meets woman. They fall in love. They go on the honeymoon. And then they hit bottom. They hit Earth. You know, the real problems of life sort of come up. But what happens when they hit Earth is when they arrived on Earth, this lush place, but the spaceship crashed. And they were fine. Everything was all right, except one problem. They had selective amnesia. They forgot they were from different planets. And as soon as we forget that we're supposed to be different, as soon as they forgot they're from different planets, then the fight started coming in. Then the tension started coming in because they did one thing. They started trying to change each other instead of nurture each other just the way they are. Because naturally, if someone's feeling loved the way they are, they're going to grow and become more. And I think some people's fears when they misunderstand the title of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, they think what I might be saying is, well, men and women are so different, they'll never change, they'll never understand each other, they'll never get along. And that's the opposite of what I'm saying. I'm saying if you accept someone's differences, then you can begin to understand the validity of who they are. Couples have told me, they'll say, gosh, we used to fight all the time until we read your book. And suddenly, we've always loved each other, we just stopped trying to change each other.
Right.
Once we gave up trying to change each other, we stopped fighting.
Plus, if we're all completely the same, then where is the variety of your life? Where is the texture of life? I mean, you know, if you made somebody into who you wanted them to be exactly in your own vision, there'd be no surprise. There'd be none of the opportunities that give so much of the joy to life.
Well, you know, one of the things I tell couples a lot is that when they're complaining about some of the differences or whatever, as I say, you wouldn't be attracted to each other if there weren't differences. It's like, I'm attracted to my wife, Bonnie. She has certain qualities that I don't automatically express.
Right.
They're deep inside me, but through loving her and having a relationship with her and sometimes struggling to validate her point of view, which isn't always easy, okay, to see the
I'm
value.
I'm going to play this tape for her, John.
Right. So, but when I have to sort of stretch my consciousness to include her awareness in mine, it makes me a better person. It makes me a more loving person, a more compassionate person, but I make a lot of better decisions in life as well. I mean, I'm more of who I can be through loving someone who's different from me.
Well, then let's get right to it then. Tell me, what's the difference between a Martian and a Venusian? Right. Let's talk about what are some of the emotional need differences, maybe some communication differences as well.
Well, I think the easiest way to see the differences, which I like to focus on now, is when we look at what are some of the biggest mistakes men and women make in relationships.
Great. What's one of my questions?
One of the things that women will do as a normal Venusian thing, and this isn't a mistake, but we men don't understand it and we make mistakes about it. A woman will tend to come home from the day. She has a stressful day, whether she's working or she's been with the kids all day, whichever, or both. She comes home, husband comes home. First thing she wants to do is talk. She wants to talk about everything that went wrong that day. She, oh, this happened, and this happened, I can't believe this happened, and why didn't you call then, and da-da-da, you know.
And the guy's going, I came home to escape all that.
That's it. That's the Martian thing. See, but Martians come home, and men come home, and they've got all their stress. They want to forget their problems. They want to leave their problems behind. Women come home. They have those problems. They want to talk about their problems. And what we don't know as men is that when they're talking about it, we think we're supposed to solve those problems.
Right.
We think that she won't be happy, she can't relax unless those problems get solved. Because for us, we have two ways of dealing with problems. We either solve them, or if there's nothing we can do to solve it, we temporarily forget it.
Right.
So the fact that she's bringing these issues up, we think...
Adds to our burden.
It adds to our burden. We feel like, gosh, I've just been working all day, now I got to solve these problems. And another hidden burden is the man instinctively feels, well, she's got all these problems, she's not going to be a happy woman until we solve them all.
Right.
So that's why he starts being really... In a hurry, in a sense, to well, this is what you have to do about this, and don't worry about this.
What happens when he starts to try and solve these problems?
So that's where the tension comes in between men and women, because as soon as he starts trying to solve the problems, the feeling she has is he's trying to shut her up, that he doesn't care about what she's going through.
She starts
to feel you're not listening. So then what she'll say is, honey, he'll say, this is what you ought to do. And she'll say, no, you don't understand. And he goes, what do you mean I don't understand? I heard what you said. Of course I understand. But what she really means when she says you don't understand is what she really means is, you don't understand, John. I don't want you to solve these problems. I don't want you to fix anything. I just want you to understand what I'm going through. I've had a difficult day. I just really want you to listen. Empathize, make a few nice gestures, noises, like...
But I do understand. That's why I want to help you.
That's right. And it is true. That's what men... They understand and they want to solve the problem. But what we have to learn is, man.
Men say, why would we have talk about a problem and not do something to solve
right.
it?
That's right. What's the point in it? Why even talk about it? You know?
Every woman wants to say, listen to these two men having a great time talking about women.
Right.
So tell me then. So what should we do? What should men do specifically?
So the one of the techniques, and I think it's in my book, What Your Mother Couldn't Tell You, Your Father Didn't Know. It's skills, techniques that our fathers couldn't teach us. They didn't know. One of the skills in there I teach men is called ducking and dodging. Okay. When she's talking about problems, men hear it as solutions. I mean, right. that we're being called upon to solve it. And so what you do is just duck. Let it pass by. Let it pass by. Don't give the solution. Keep ducking. And sometimes women will say things like, which men take personally. She'll say things like, oh, we never spend time together, or you never listen to me, or we're always rushing. And a guy will hear those expressions and he'll take them personally. What do you mean we're always rushing? We weren't rushing last Thursday night. I did a great job that night. That's called taking it personally. And of course, the woman will say, well, why can't you just listen? I'm not talking about you. And he says, well, you're talking about me. You're talking to me. It's about me.
Right.
So we have to just, that's called dodging. Just let it go by. Don't take it personally.
So, but when you let it go by, won't the woman feel like you're not listening?
Well, certainly. She could feel like you're not listening if you're kind of inside going, okay, let the old lady talk for a while, you know, go on and on and on. You can't do that. You know, you can't be rolling your eyes.
So how do you actively listen?
Actively listening is you look in her direction is the first thing. And this is something
in her direction, not necessarily at her, but her direction.
look in her direction. Well, you know, I could say men just look right into her eyes, but most men, if you look right into a woman's eyes while she's talking about her feelings, your mind just goes blank. You don't know what she's saying. So just look sometimes in her eyes, but look in her direction. It's the first thing. Because you know what men will do when their wives talk is after about a minute or two, we start looking away. You know, either we're thinking about
Which
what she's saying
it, right.
or we're just, our mind is getting distracted. So the first thing is body position, look in her direction. Second thing is movement of body. Occasionally move your head up and down. You know, occasionally, you know, if she's going, oh, it was awful.
Fundamentals for the Cro-Magnon man.
That's right. Fundamentals for the Cro-Magnon man. But you know what? The reality is,
Don't do it, even though it sounds so simplistic. Most of them don't do it.
But most of them don't do it.
Because men get in a trance when this happens.
That's
because
right.
what they're trying to do is they're trying to fight this need to solve the problem.
Well, most guys are waiting. We're sitting there waiting till we can now do something about it. So when are you going to get to the point? What's the problem? Let me help you here. Then we'll go on and be happy. So we're in this waiting mode instead of actively listening.
So are you telling me that women are then happy while they're expounding about the problem? Is that true?
Well, this is the irony. They're not really happy while they're talking about the problem. Sometimes they'll become even more unhappy while they're talking about it. But when they're done, they'll be really happy.
Well, when will they be done? I'm just kidding. I'm going to get killed.
Here's
all
a guy.
The women listeners are going to kill me right
now. No, but it's just you're
really
the ultimate
ask.
Martian, Tony. There's
oh, no
doubt about it.
You are. That's
But you know our point
label.
Of view very well, of course. But that's what a man's thinking when a woman is talking. She says, well, how long? And what I say to men is that you don't know how long. You never know how. But what you do is you realize that this is the thing you can do that will make a woman of the 90s is happiest. If she knows when she comes home, she can share about her day and her partner will listen attentively. But you can't just put this all on men to do. There's
yes.
a woman's role
well, that,
in this
that was
whole
my
thing.
Next question.
You know, that's
to
the
balance.
Flip side. Because men can't just do this without some help from women.
Right.
There's like I talk about how men can listen without getting upset, and that's ducking and dodging. Don't give solutions. Don't take it personally.
Right.
Now, what we do when we give solutions, and this is really a relevant
point. But let me say this one, but care about how they feel without having to solve it is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
You try to care about how they feel.
You try? Yeah,
John. No, but the reality is sometimes your wife's talking and a part of you is going, why is she talking about this? This isn't that important.
But see, I've experienced that, though, even on issues where it's not a problem. I remember one time Becky and I went to the south of France and we were on this incredibly busy schedule. And then she said, I want to go. We looked at we went to a meeting at an old home, an old chateau. And she said, oh, my gosh, I would so love to have a place like this. I'd love to come and live here for a month. And immediately I was like, a month? Come here. This place is dark. It's terrible. I don't have any time anymore. Buy another house. I can't buy another house. We got houses we've never even seen. I was so stressed out. We had this really intense, I turned into this argument about how ungrateful she is for all that I do. You know, I was such a perfect Martian. And at the end, she said to me, finally got to communicating. She goes, I don't have to have this place. Can I just dream? I said, dream. You dream to a achieve. If you dream something, I gotta make it happen. Don't you understand? You can't put a dream out there and expect me not to manifest it. That's my job in life, right? You know? So I don't think it's just problems this happens with. I think sometimes it has to do with mutual goals or
absolutely,
desires.
Absolutely, absolutely. There, for single women, for example, this is something they don't realize, a way they unknowingly turn off men. Because a woman could be driving through, a guy could be courting a woman and happen to be going by beautiful homes. And let's say he doesn't see one day him buying, being able to afford that home.
Right.
And she's over there going, wow, look at that home. It's beautiful. They got that pool in the back. Oh, I'd love to live in a home like that. She's just dreaming, like you're saying. He's thinking, she wants me to buy a house like that? She's going to have a pool like that? There's no way I'm going to be able to afford that for her. This woman, I'll never be able to please her. I'll never be able to make her happy. And then he'll start pulling away. And she wasn't saying, you've got to provide this for me.
Right.
She's just saying, wouldn't that be really wonderful?
But what you're really describing is, if and tell me if this is accurate, is that women are more process-oriented as a gross generalization. Because I have to say about all of this is these are metaphors.
Yeah,
they're gross generalizations about the society as a whole. They aren't individuals because they're individual exceptions to all these people.
Right.
But as a generalization, understand another gender or another person from another planet, are women then more process-oriented, and does their physiology, you know, help to contribute to that? Because we have differences in our physiology that are very real.
Huge differences in physiology. And first, to answer the first question, yes, women tend to be much more process-oriented, and men tend to be much more goal-oriented.
Completion,
so completion-oriented. So let's give an example of what that means for people, okay? Because process-oriented would mean my wife would come to me and want to talk about something, and she doesn't even have a goal in mind. She just knows there's problems or issues or something good to talk about, but she hasn't yet planned anything about it. She hasn't even thought about what we're going to do. She could be talking about Hawaii, and she's not yet even planning a vacation to Hawaii. Whereas a man, if he's going to go talk to his wife about Hawaii, he's going to first think, all right, maybe we ought to have a vacation in Hawaii. Let me go see if I can afford a vacation in Hawaii.
Right.
Let me see if there's some place I'd really want to go. Let me figure out the best island to go to. Then I'd say, honey, let's go on a vacation in Hawaii. What do you think? And her reaction is, what? You did all this planning and you're thinking about all this stuff and you didn't even include me? Isn't my point of view important to you? Because see, that's the whole thing. And even in business, women make this mistake a lot. They'll go to an upper-level management position and they'll share problems with the upper-level management. Mm. And the guy, particularly if it's a man, he'll think, so what are you going to do about it? And in many cases, she hasn't even gotten to the solution. She would feel it's rude to talk about the solution without first everybody having a voice to talk about the problem or talk about the issue. Once we've fully talked about it, that's the process of getting there. Then we decide where exactly we want to go, what we want to do about it.
Right.
So it's important that we understand the differences from each other's point of view.
Does physiology play a role in that? Or is that cultural conditioning or both?
Well, certainly there's some cultural conditioning here.
Sure.
But there's physiology, and that's what's becoming more and more known each year. And it's very exciting research, particularly in the brain. The brain research shows that men and women's brains, certainly there's a lot of similarities, but there's a lot of differences. And even more importantly, how we use our brains is different. Repeatedly, the studies, which are the most current studies, are showing men will tend to use one part of the brain at a time. It's like task-oriented, project-oriented.
Right.
What are we going to do? How are we going to get there? Whereas women will tend to use many parts of the brain at the same time.
Right.
So she could be exploring and talking and slowly developing her idea of what she wants to do or what she doesn't want to do. And I'm not saying men can't do this. But our tendency is if there's a problem, let's get right to the solution. We have in our brain, there's certain hormones that allow us to control impulses. Men have less of those than women. Women will tend to, if they're upset about something, their tendency is to want to talk first before acting. Men will have a tendency, if there's distress or danger or lots of anger or hurt or fear, we want to do something right away.
Right.
So when we're talking to our wives, and she seems to be distressed about something, we immediately want to do something.
Right.
And this, you know, we said, why are we this different? Well, if you look back to, you know, the basic role we men have had in women's lives for thousands of years, if there's a problem, we have to go and you know, shoot an animal or kill somebody or do something. We're in the dangerous role. And when you have a dangerous job, you have to learn how to react fast.
Mm.
So when there's fear, you act fast. Whereas, so we have much faster reaction in our brain when there's emotions to do something, whereas women have much more reaction to talk about it.
Well, what do you think? Did I tell you these people were remarkable? Did I exaggerate? I don't think so. They're amazing souls. They're not only brilliant, but you get a sense of what really makes them tick as people. They're such good people, and I really am grateful to count them as friends and as coaches, because I learn a lot from each of these people.
So I hope you've enjoyed this kind of mini power talk. Normally we have a whole hour or more just for an interview. Here you only got a little piece here and there, but I wanted you to get a little taste both of power talk and of some tools and some philosophies that could make a difference. And I hope that the conversations you heard with them inspire you to apply what you've learned, but also inspire you to continue our relationship. I feel very, very privileged to have spent this 30 days with you, and I hope that you're not tired of me and would like to continue it. We all need to build a set of references. You know, I may not need the idea right now. I tell this to kids very often. You know, I say, when you're in school, you capture everything. Because you might say, this doesn't relate to my life. It may not today, but it will. And what we all have to do is build a reference library, of what I would call profound knowledge. That's what I'm about. Every moment I'm alive, I'm listening for those tools, those strategies, those distinctions that, man, once you know them, boom, instantly, you can take what you've learned and improve the quality of your life or anyone you have the privilege to touch. So this is a chance, I think, Power Talk, for you and I to continue our relationship, for you to remind yourself, once a month at least, to be at your best, something you can do in your car and so forth, but also a chance to build a success reference library, a comprehensive library of the tools to have the quality of life that you deserve, and so do your family and friends. So I hope you'll decide to continue with me in this endeavor. And if you do, then you'll be coming with me as I travel around the world and continue to seek out those leaders that are showing us the way, those leaders that are setting the example, those extraordinary human beings who have shown us what is really possible. So if you'd like to be a part of Power Talk and receive it once a month, be sure to call 800 number and we'll continue our relationship. Till then, thank you once again for listening. Make sure you take some massive action today. Do something remarkable, and most importantly, live with passion.
If you'd like to receive Anthony Robbins' monthly audio magazine, Power Talk, which includes a one-on-one session from Tony to help you improve your personal and professional life, an interview with a person of great achievement and influence, plus a concise summary of a best-selling book, please call 1-800-445-8183. Call now, 1-800-445-8183.